Okay, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our warm-up speaker, Daniel.
Hello, everybody. My name is Daniel, and I'm an alcoholic. And, man, it's a real honor to be here with you guys. Really big thanks for taking time to greet us and take us out to dinner. I didn't find out I was going to be the warm-up speaker until about 4 o'clock when Mary called. And we were getting ready to leave the house. And she goes, oh, yeah, he'll do it. She goes, babe, you're going to be the warm-up speaker. And, you know, all I could think about is, you know, I'll warm you up anytime. You know? I say that because I've waited a long time to have what I have today. You know, I was talking to Brother Rick at the restaurant, and I don't know a lot of the book by memory or anything, or where to automatically turn to find something, but I know somewhere in there says, are we willing to do what we do, wife or no wife, job or no job, you know. And I came in here November 10th, 2000, and when I came in to fix a marriage. I've been in and out of church my whole life, but my relationship with my higher power has been one of a genie in a lamp type thing. But just real quick about my past, I grew up out in Carruthers, and I was sharing some stories with Rick, you know, and back then the times were different. The price tags for drinking weren't that high yet if you got caught. But I didn't pay attention to the price tags that I was paying. At 19 years old, I was drunk and going out to get some drugs on a motorcycle. I wiped out doing 110, broke my neck in two places, split my head wide open. There was no helmet law back then. My family found me on this little tiny road. The ambulance couldn't find me, but my family had to watch me lay there with my head busted open. And anyhow, they said I'd never walk again. You know, some church family came down and they prayed for me. I didn't think much of it, but I walked out of the hospital in 5 days. I had a halo brace on. Most of my difficulties have been not knowing how to live life. You know, I don't have any war stories or tough guy stuff. All my problems were in-house things. All my price tags were in-house things. And if you ever wanted to know the real truth about me, just ask my kids or my ex-wife. You know, they could tell you. Like my sponsor told me that one day. I got into a meeting, and I came in all happy. I was about 5 minutes late, and he said, I was going around greeting everybody. And I got to him. He goes, sit down, Daniel, and don't be late. And I'm thinking, man, can't this guy see my family's with me? He's embarrassing me, you know. Another time, one of the times that my ex-wife left, I called him up, and I had my crybaby voice on, and I said, Tony, my wife left. And he was, get to a meeting, Daniel. And I said, but she took the car, you know, and I was trying to sound, you know. And he said, well, start walking, and you better not be late. And, man, all of a sudden, my crybaby went to anger. I said, this blankety-blank person's got two cars, and he can't come get me. You know what I mean? But I started walking, and I was angry, and I was kicking rocks and calling him all kinds of names and stuff. But something happened on the walk to the meeting. I started taking an inventory of where I was at and how I got there. I think for the first 2 years of going through a divorce, I was focusing on everybody else's faults. Bernard's my sponsor, so I've never had what I have today. You know, before I quit drinking, my house was full of people. You know, today, the only people that come around are my children, my grandchildren. The true friends that I have, I can count them on one hand. But I know they're there, man. And those friends, they got a nickname for me back in Fresno. They call me a Gion, which in English is the crybaby. So I'm sitting here, and I was asking my higher power, hey, Dad, you know, guide my words up there, man. Help me to say what you want me to say. And man, please don't let me cry, man, because I don't want to cry by these people. But you know what? If it happens, it happens, man. The one thing that I'm very grateful for, I didn't know how to be real. You know, even when I was drinking, I didn't know how to be real. I got along with everybody, but if I hung around with a certain ethnic group, I dressed and acted like them. The next day, I had three sets of clothes and three dialogues, you know. But you guys told me if I stuck around long enough that I was going to find Daniel in these rooms, you know. In fact, my first meeting I went to, I knew nothing about AA. But I went into my home group and I sat down. There was an old man there. Nobody was there yet. And he poured me a cup of coffee. He goes, "Have a seat, young man. We're going to love you till you learn how to love yourself." All the things, all those little sayings you guys told me back then, I didn't understand. You know, in November, I'll be coming up on 16 years and the lights are barely clicking on. Oh, okay, I get it, Dad. I get it. My father passed away a year before I got sober. And after I got over the divorce thing, I remember sitting at a meeting and saying, "Shit, now what?" Because I only came in here to make her stay. I figured, you know, that was my relationship with God, making deals, you know. And hey, I'll go do this and be a good boy, but fix this, you know, like bring him broken toys, man. And the little sayings that the guys in here told me. Hey, Daniel, I remember I came in crying, telling you guys what she had done, and it was all her fault. And this one lady told me one time, says, "Hey, Dan, why don't you try cleaning up your side of the street, man? Look, try it for a year. If it doesn't work, you can always go back to doing it your way, you know." And that sounded pretty good. Shortly after that, I got Tony, and I was outside, and I remember he was dressed real sharp, and he had these nice Stacy's on, and he was outside smoking a cigarette, and I tried to pull the same stuff on him, and I don't know how far I got about telling him how bad my wife was, but I remember he threw his cigarette down, stepped in it, and he says, "Dad, knock that shit off. You did this." And I was like, man, that little switch in the back of my head went off. I don't know if you guys probably have it, but when you feel like you're being disrespected, my first reaction is not a good one. And today I know it because I'm out of place. Back then I thought it was your fault because you had crossed that line of pride that I had out. And today I don't know if it was Bernard or Tony told me one day, "Hey, Daniel, in here you can do whatever you want to do, but you better be willing to pay the price, man. You can't say you don't know anymore. You're accountable today." That's been a slow process, man, because I got a lot of defects. You know, I've been married twice. I'll be 58 in November. I'm in a beautiful relationship today. And one of the best tools that AA has given me is a timeout, because I get out of place. I get my feelings hurt. Or I have to take a timeout and say, "Okay, what's my part, Dad?" Because if I open my mouth at that time, all I know is the old stuff. And then I hear Bernard's voice or Tony's voice saying, "You can do what you want to do, but there's a price tag for that." So I have to take a quick inventory of what the hell it cost me last time. But that's the best I can do, is not do the old thing. I don't know what to do yet, so I got to go. I'm glad we have an extra room, you know, because I go to the other room and lock myself in there, man, and sit there. And sometimes I pout like a little kid, man, you know, because I'm not getting what I want out of life. But at least I know I'm out of place. And I don't have to hurt anybody else. And after the anger subsides, I start talking to God. I said, "Hey, Dad, I need help today, man." You know, and in Mary's program, and it helps me so much. He says, "Well, when you're hungry, let me know." You know, so it avoids arguments. I've never had that. I didn't know how to communicate. If somebody pushed my buttons or pulled my strings, I only knew one reaction. And with that reaction, the blinders would kick on, and I wouldn't think of the consequences. If I was going to hurt somebody or get hurt or lose a job or lose a relationship, because I had already given myself the right by your actions. Today, I'm not picking up real big price tags, man. You know, I have beautiful children, beautiful grandchildren. you guys taught me how to stay on my side of the street. I kind of strayed the other day, and I had to be put in place, and it hurt my feelings. And Mary and I were laying there, and I got a text message from my son. Something happened at their household, and I called. I kept calling. They didn't answer. 2 days later, I got a text message from my son saying, "Hey, Dad, can you chill out on the phone calls? You're just making things worse over here." And I'm like, shit, man. You know, sometimes my intentions are good, but if I don't take a minute and think about what I'm doing, my old reactions still cause problems, intentional or not. And sometimes I don't deal well with hurt feelings. I'm still looking at your part. You know, guys, I don't have a lot to say other than AA has taught me how to live a new life today. I don't have heavy price tags. We're going through some things at home right now, and yet I get up, and it only takes me a few minutes to get in place and say, "Hey, Dan, you have it in your power what kind of day you're going to have today." You know, I've been begging God for this my whole life. I'm blessed to be involved with H&I, with Bernard and Tony and some other guys, and we go out to Avenel State Prison. And I was there Monday, and I started sharing some of the things I was going through at home, and the guy sitting next to me tapped me on the shoulder. These guys, I've been going there 15 years. These guys are like my family. And he tapped me on the shoulder, and he goes, "Hey, Dan, I'll trade you places." I said, "No, that's okay, man." He goes, "Okay, stop crying then." And I said, "Oh, man, all right, brother, you got it, you know." I have a wonderful life out there, guys, you know. I do this to keep what I have out there, but it's not a making deals thing. This is what keeps me in line, you know. I'll close with this. I have wonderful relatives over in the Merced area, and they've been Christians for a long time. And they support me a great deal, but every once in a while the religious part gets in the way, and they let me know that I'm not doing things their way. And I got this phone call, and started off good for the first few seconds, and then it quickly went to, "You know what, you need to stop going to the prison and hanging around with those people. You need to be around godly people and seek God's will in your life." And I'm thinking, man, okay. And I had a bad problem and still do with a people-pleasing thing, you know, because I've always tried to make them happy. And I made the mistake of trying to make her understand. It didn't go well. And so I said, "Dan, just be quiet, man." And what came out was, and I told her, "You know what, dear, I'll take everything you told me into consideration, you know. And I'll work on it." And she said, "Okay, Pops, I love you." You know, Tony taught me, "Dan, you got to allow people to be wrong, man. It doesn't mean they're wrong, but just because we don't agree on something doesn't make me wrong either. See, you guys give me a coin once a year that says, 'To thine own self be true.' I'm coming up on 16 years, and I've never been sober more than 2 or 3 years in my life, you know. But I was sitting in that prison chapel, thinking about the phone call I had got that day, and this young man that I see on a weekly basis came up to me with a styrofoam cup, and his hands were shaking, and he said, "Dan, taste this." And I took a drink, and I said, "This is pretty good." He goes, "Yeah, I've been watching how much sugar and cream you put in, and I couldn't wait for you to get here because I wanted to see if I could make coffee just the way you liked it." And, man, I sat there, and my eyes got watery, and I just started thinking to myself, "You know, Dad, if these are not godly people, man, I don't know what is, man. I'm right where I'm supposed to be, you know. I don't have to people please today. I don't have to jump through hoops. But if I don't do this on a daily basis, I fall back into old behavior, man, and all of a sudden I'm not good enough again, you know. And when I get into that feeling less than, that inferiority, it's not a pretty, I go to extremes. I either go to the macho crap of trying to run the show, or I go to the extreme of, "Baby, I don't care how you treat me, just don't leave me," you know. I'm in a good place today. Mary, I love you. And, you know, I'm going to turn it over to Mary so she can tell you her story. And I thank you for allowing me to be here. I love you guys. Thank you.
Okay, let's give a rousing Tulare County welcome to our featured speaker, Mary.
Thank you, everyone. Perfect. I was afraid it was going to be real high and I would have to be like that. First of all, I'd like to say my name is Mary and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to ask, is there anybody here that has a problem with me talking about drugs? Some people have a problem with it, but in the big book it does talk about drugs. Several stories talk about it though. But I didn't know that little gadget was there. I started drinking at the age of 9. My mom and my dad, they met in college, in Bible college, Christian college. My father's a pastor till this day, and my mother was a Sunday school teacher at the time. And when they separated, when I was 7 years old, that's when all the drinking and all the partying started. And I remember I kept going to church on the Sunday school bus, and one Sunday I got off the Sunday school bus, and my mom's boyfriend poured me a glass of beer and, you know, put it towards me and said, "Órale, tómale," which means go ahead and drink it. And I said, "But I'm too little." And I turned around to look at my mom to see if my mom would back me up, and she was smashing beans at the time, and she stuck it in my face, and she said, "Don't ever say no to someone when they offer you something, because you make them feel bad." So ever since then, I've never said no. So everything that was offered to me, I took it. You know how when people start partying, they want everybody to join in. I remember when I was little, my mom used to give me some money and tell me to take it to Joe Blow down the street, and he's going to give me a bag and for me not to drop it or I'd be in trouble. That's how I started learning what pills were, different kind of pills. Back then, there were pink hearts, yellow jackets, black beauties, cross tops. And I started taking some out of the bag when I started learning what they were, what they do to you, and I started selling them at school. I was in and out of juvenile hall. By the time I was 10, I was already sniffing paint and sniffing glue. By the time I was 12, I was already taking acid. And 14, I went to New Mexico to try their stuff because I wanted something stronger. I tried, their peyote over there, which was pretty good. By the time I was 15, I was strung out on heroin and cocaine, living on the streets, homeless. Already had a son taken away from me at 8 months. I got pregnant at 14, had him at 15. I was just a kid having a kid. Didn't know nothing about being a mother. I remember going to my first alcohol program at 15. I didn't stay very long. The next bus that drove up at Santa Rosa. It was one of my friends from my hometown, and when she got off the bus, I thought, "Oh shit, here comes trouble," because I knew something was gonna, that we weren't gonna stay very long, and we didn't. We stayed for a couple weeks after that, and I ran away, and we saw these two old guys at a liquor store. And we told them, "We'll buy you a case of beer if you give us a ride home." Well, he didn't know where home was. We took him from Santa Rosa to Modesto. And we went into a liquor store and we told them, "We're going to go get you some more beer." And we ran inside the store and went out the back door. And God knows where those guys ended up, Today, I hope, I always tell myself, "God, I wish I would run into these people that I've done these things to apologize to them, to make my amends to them." But after that, I kept going in and out of juvenile hall. I ended up going to a foster home, ended up running away from there. My foster mother, I was the only girl there, and she told me, "If I ever lose you, that I'm going to quit my job as a foster mother and I'm going to sell my house and move out of state." I didn't believe her until she did. I went back looking for her 1 year, and The house was sold. She moved out of state and I couldn't find her. I had run away from her house twice just to go drink with some friends. But I was doing stuff in her house too because I was cleaning her mom's house, who was a sugar diabetic, so I was getting my needles from her. But my foster mother didn't know it. She probably did, but you know how we're the only ones that don't, we think nobody knows, but everybody else knows it. But, and then I was going in and out of juvenile hall, and then I went to jail for the first time, and they got tired of seeing me in jail, so they sent me to prison, in the late 80s, and I got out in 91, before I got locked up. We were at a motel room, and I remember getting robbed. I had a gun to my head and a knife to my throat. That's when I was 15 when this happened. That's how I ended up in my foster home when I got locked up again. They ended up sending me to a foster home because I didn't have a home to go to when they were going to release me, so they put me on a list for a foster home. Because my mom was a big-time dope dealer and a hard drinker. So I ended up going to a foster home at 15. But when I got locked up, I ran into this girl that robbed us. And when I went to prison, I had two sisters there, and I had some cousins there and a stepmother. So, we had to do what we had to do to survive in there. But when I first got out and I came to Fresno in 91, my parole officer used to tell me, I want to use you to send you around the schools to talk about drug prevention, alcohol prevention, and prison life and all this other stuff. And I said, okay, cool. The first time I went and talked about my story, I shared my story with the third graders. And I told him, why do third graders, they're so little? He goes, because that's where your story started, and we have a lot of kids going through the same thing. And I was like, wow, okay. Because here, I'm, early 20s, I can't see myself giving a little kid money and telling him take it to a drug house. I have a 15-year-old now, and I can't see myself smoking a joint with him or giving him a line or something like that, But I went and I shared my story around the schools. When I got into recovery in 91, I got into the program called The Choice. I was the only female. We went around all the schools in Fresno, Fowler, Sanger, talking about drug prevention, alcohol prevention, and prison life and child abuse and stuff like that. And right when we were going to start getting paid, because everything was volunteering, and right when we were going to start getting paid to do stuff like that at Roosevelt High School, I quit because my son fell off the bed. He was only 7 months old, and he cracked his skull, so I decided to stay home and take care of him instead of my mom. So I stayed home to watch him. That was my second son. Let's see. It's hot in here. I'm sweating. But when I got into this program the first time in 91, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought I was a drug addict. And I kept telling my mom, why do you keep dragging me to AA? Because when I was sitting in prison, she was here in Fresno. She was in Fresno already with 5 years clean and sober. When she was going to leave Fresno, she went to the county jail to see if she could find us there. And, of course, all three of her girls were there. And she sat us all down. She had a visiting with us, and she told us about the program in Fresno because she kept trying to get clean in Modesto, where we're from, and she couldn't do it because it was only a 30-day program. Who can get sober in 30 days, right? So she kept coming over to visit us, and every time she kept coming over to see, me and my brothers, she would always end up slipping, doing something. Whatever we were doing, she ended up doing it with us. So she ended up getting kicked out of the program. But and then she found a program, I don't know how, she found a program here in Fresno, or over there in Fresno. And it was, I think, a year program, and she told us about it, and I told her, yeah, go ahead and do it. If you want to change your life, go ahead and do it. Because I had already had a taste of sobriety when I was 15. So sitting in jail, I told her, you know, that's the only way you're going to be able to change your life is you leave Modesto. So she did. Before she did, she told me, she goes, yeah, but I don't want to leave my babies behind. And I told her, Mom, we're not babies. We're, you know, all in our 20s and we're all in jail. So, you know, we're not your babies no more. So she did. She left and she went to Modesto. And when I was sitting in prison, every time I wrote her a letter, I always put at the bottom, P.S., when I grow up, I want to be just like you. Because she always wrote me letters telling me how her school was going, how class was, and how she got an A in her test. And she was studying to be an RN. And, you know, when she graduated, I wanted to be there, but I couldn't because I was locked up somewhere. So when I got out, I went straight to Fresno where she was at. And then come Monday, I was supposed to be in Modesto to test and talk to my parole officer. So Monday, we went down there. My mom and my aunt and myself went down there. And they switched my parole agent from Modesto to Fresno, and that's where I stayed. But my mom dragged me to all these meetings, and it was always AA. It was always alcohol. It was always alcohol. And I told her, Mom, I don't have a problem with alcohol. She goes, Mary, it's not what you drink, what kind of you drink, or what kind of fancy bottle it's in, or what fancy glass it's in. It's what it does to you after the fact. And she knows when I drink, I break out in felonies. So she... So that's why she knew I was an alcoholic, but I didn't. I kept telling her, but I'm a drug addict. I do more drugs than I drink. But every time I drank, I always wanted something stronger. So that's why I ended up doing something stronger. I always looked for something stronger. But it always started out with drinking. So I kept, you know, so I stayed in the program. I had 4 years clean. I got my sponsor, and I started doing the steps, and, you know, of course, I did them half-assed because, again, I wasn't an alcoholic. So I did my steps half-assed, and I didn't even do them right. And then I met this guy in the program, and, of course, they tell us not to get into a relationship the first year of your recovery. And I looked at this lady, and I told her, are you crazy? I just got out of prison doing 3 years, you know, and... Of course I'm going to jump in a relationship, and of course I did, and it didn't turn out right, so, you know, everything went all in the handbag and went upstream. So I met this other guy, and we hooked up, and I was doing a lot of speaking engagements, and even though I wasn't an alcoholic, but I kept doing a lot of speaking engagements, I was doing a lot of meetings, I was being, you know, secretaries for different meetings, and when I met him... The man of my dreams, supposedly, we ended up getting married, and we were married for 15 years, but as soon as we hooked up, I stopped going to meetings. I stopped hanging out with clean and sober people, you know, I stopped calling my sponsor, and the reason why I stopped going to meetings was because people smoked in the meetings, and it was too stuffy in there, and I was pregnant, and I didn't want to be around that, so I just quit going altogether. And of course, the drinking started. I stayed sober for 15 years through church. I got really heavily involved into church. After a while, I ended up stopped going there. I started drinking again, and at first it was okay because I would have one or two beers, get that little slight buzz, and then I'd quit because I'd call it a night because I had to be up at 6 in the morning with the kids for school and to send him off to work. Well, like the book says, you know, when drinking, it just progresses. So it did. It progressed. It got worse. I started getting fights with him and started going into blackouts. Don't remember how I got home. I just remember falling out of the truck and my son trying to help me up, my five-year-old, and I would just tell him, just go inside with Dad. I'm going to stay out here, and I'm laid out on the grass. excuse me. So that went on for a while, and then I guess he got tired of my drinking, and... 1 year, he went camping, And he told me, when you go pick up your sister from Chowchilla, do me a favor, don't drink. I said, oh, no, I'm just going to pick her up, bring her home. Her husband's going to come pick her up from Ventura, and that's it. He said, okay, well, by the time he got home, I was drunk, my sister was drunk, and we picked up my little sister, and she was drunk, and his daughter was there, and she was drinking, and it was a mess. And we had a dinner date planned for that night, and I remember telling my son, I may have to come home walking, but I'm coming home. Because I already knew what I was going to do. I was going to confront him about him flirting and trying to kiss some other woman, which was my sister. You know when they say when you get drunk, the truth comes out? My sister told me all kinds of crap. So I ended up confronting him at Carol's restaurant, and we got thrown out. Long story short, we got thrown out, got in a fight in the parking lot. The cops came and everything, and they let me walk it off. I walked home the wrong direction, but I got there. I ended up getting there, you know, sooner or later, hours later. But 3 days later, we ended up splitting up because of that, you know. He wouldn't talk to me, so I said, well, what the hell? So I ended up leaving home. I remember going to this one girl's house, and she was in recovery. She's a really good friend of mine. I went to her house because I needed somebody to talk to. And he called me, and he goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm over here at so-and-so's house because I need somebody to talk to. You're not talking to me. And then he goes, well, you're my wife. You belong here at home. And I said, well, I'll be home later. He goes, I'm tired of your games. Every 30 days you tell me you love me, and every 30 days you tell me you hate me. You know, you love me, you hate me. He goes, what is it? I'm tired of your games. You might as well find your own place to live. And I said, that's all I needed was a green light. And I hung up. The next day I went and grabbed all my stuff and moved in with my friend who was in recovery. But I kept drinking. And, of course, I wasn't an alcoholic. I kept drinking, and it was getting worse, and it was progressing. I started drinking and driving. What made me stop and come back to recovery in 2009 was that my son, he was 15 at the time, he was telling me, Mom, you had Jesse scared, who was only 8 at the time. He's a special child. He has Asperger's and autistic behavior. He says, at the time, you had him in the back seat of the car crying, Mom, that was a stop sign. And, Mom, you just passed the red light. And, you know, and I used to always tell myself, I'm not going to do to my kids what my parents did to us. You know, my mom was drunk all the time, drinking and driving with us in the car, always beating on us. Her boyfriends, we would always be fighting all throughout our lives because she always dated younger men, and the younger men would try to hit on us girls, so us girls would corner them in a corner of the house and just beat on them. And then when I was 13, I forgot to say this one story. When I was 13, I went to juvenile hall, and now I know it's H&I. Back then, I didn't know it was H&I, but they had an AA meeting there, and I wanted to go just because we could fraternize with the boys because it was a co-ed juvenile hall. So I went to this AA meeting, and I remember this lady talking about her story. I don't remember nothing else, but the one part that she said, she was drinking, and she lived in the outskirts of the town, and she went home. The following morning, she woke up to drink a beer outside on her porch, and she saw blood on her bumper, and she don't know what she hit or who she hit. She just knew she had to wash the blood off her car before her kids seen it. And that's the only part of the story I remember, and I know it was a lady that said it. So when my 15-year-old told me that I picked up my 8-year-old from school, that I had him in the back seat of the car and he was crying, you know, the following morning, when he's telling me the story, all I kept thinking about was that lady's story. I don't remember picking him up from school. I could have hit any kid on that school campus. You know, at the time, my 8-year-old was always getting in trouble at school before they diagnosed him with Asperger's and autistic behavior and a defiancy disorder. you know, that story came into my mind, and that's the only story that I remember. But, you know, maybe that's the only story God wanted me to remember. But that's what made me come back to recovery in 09. I came back to the program. I started, you know, I got a sponsor and started working the steps. And the first time around in 91, my sponsor told me why I had to do a four-step. Because I kept telling her, that shit happened 20 years ago. I don't need to take care of all that crap. I don't need to bring all that stuff up again. You know, every time I talked about it, I'd get angry, and she goes, that's why. She goes, why do you get angry? And I said, because I didn't pull the trigger, you know. And she would say, well, we need to talk about this. You need to write it down and all this stuff. And I never understood it because I wasn't ready. But in 09, when I came back to this program, I was ready. Because before I started working on my steps, I went to this meeting at the Harmony House, which is a men's program. A lot of us would get together and go support the men who was in that program. I remember sitting in the corner of that meeting, and this guy started sharing, and he was crying. And he kept, and he said, I remember getting dragged to the country, getting beaten, and being left out there for death. And then I'm sitting there, and I'm crying. And the girl that went with me goes, hey, why are you crying? And I told her, because that was me. And when they called on me, I started to share, and I told them, you know what, I'm sorry. I apologize, because that was me dragging people out to the country, to the field, you know, stripping them down, tying them to a tree, beating them to death, and just leaving them out there to die. And, you know, I honestly believe that that guy in that meeting, God sent him there for me to apologize to him for all the people that I have hurt like that. That's the only thing that could come to my mind. So in 09, when I came, I started working on my steps, and boy, I put everything on there. I put everything I've done, everyone I've hurt, everyone I had a resentment towards. But you know, it's true when they say that you don't do a four step only one time. You constantly have to do your steps over and over and over. 1, 2, and 3, we know we do that on a daily basis, and you know. 10 and 11 and 12 too, but a fourth step, I'm working on another fourth step, because the first time I did my fourth step, we were getting ready to do my fifth step, and we were right in the middle of it when my sponsor says, hey, it's 8 o'clock, it's time to go, we have a speaker meeting to be at. So we just packed up my stuff, jumped in the car, and ran to a speaker meeting. And then when we got together again, we started on my sixth step. And I was like, hey, what happened to the fifth step? We didn't finish it. She goes, oh, it's okay, we'll start the sixth step. So then when I got this other sponsor, we're working on my fourth step now, because I have resentments towards a couple of people in the meeting where I go. So I thought to myself, you know, for a long time I've had these resentments for a few years now, and man, maybe since 91. But anyways, I got to write these people down and write out the resentments, and you know, maybe it's going to work this time, because now I see them in meetings and I'm okay with that. I'm okay with one of them's my uncle. I can go up to him and hug him and tell him, you know, hi, how are you doing? You know, his wife just died, which is my aunt, and I had a resentment towards her, and I never wanted to tell him anything, because I wanted to confront him and tell him how I felt about him and where he can go, but I didn't want to tell him anything, because my aunt was there, and she didn't, you know, I didn't want to get her, you know, hurt her feelings. But now that she's gone, I feel like now I can go tell this dude where he can go, right? Because well, he's my uncle through marriage. We're not really blood. But anyways, I started praying for him like the book says, and God forbid, it worked. You know, now I feel like I don't have to face him. I don't have to confront him. I don't have to tell him anything. It's just to let it go. So I'm helping him with the services of my aunt who passed away. you know, it got to the point where I wanted to go in the meeting where everybody knows him because he's very popular, and I wanted to tell everybody what he did and how he did it and why he did it and everything else, and just wanted to confront him. But, and then make my amends after, you know. But I know that's not how it works. I just wanted to be naughty, I guess. I don't know. But anyways, you know, the old me sometimes wants to come out. But anyways, like the book says, to pray for the ones that you have a resentment towards and you don't want to really make amends to them is to keep praying for them, and then it will pass, you know, and it did. I've done that for a couple of people already, and it works. How it works, I don't know, and I don't care. As long as it works, you know, it just works. So I continue to pray for him every day, every morning when I get up, because I get up before everybody else gets up in the house, and that's my quiet time to do my prayer and to do my meditation and to read my book and to do what I want to do for me before the family gets up. You know, when I first came into this program, I wanted to be like everybody else. I wanted to be the secretary. I wanted to be the intergroup rep. You know, I wanted to be the speaker to do the speaker meetings. You know, I wanted to be the speaker seeker, and I wanted to do all this stuff. And sure enough, I started doing everything, and my life started getting chaotic because I was doing too much, and my plate was too full all the time. Where I started to abandon my family, my boys at home, I kept leaving them at home and doing all these meetings and running here and there and taking the newcomer here and there, and it gets chaotic sometimes. So for the newcomers that are here, you know, it's okay to get into service, but don't overdo it. You can say no, you know, because now when somebody tells me to do something, well, no, I lied, because somebody just asked me to take the meeting for Wednesdays, and I told him, yeah, sure, no problem. And I thought, damn, I should have talked to Daniel first. I'm still learning that. But at some times, I do tell them that I can't. You know, when it's speaker meetings, I don't say no. Even though I don't want to do it or I don't feel like going, I still do it. Like tonight, I didn't know what I was going to say. I just prayed and asked God, you know, whatever comes out, and whoever shows up, you know. But when I was the missionary for all these different positions, my sponsor told me, you know, one Christmas I was at the Christmas gathering at our home group, and I felt bad. I was serving my plate, and we were standing next to each other, and I told her, damn, I should be at home making Christmas dinner for my boys instead of being here. She goes, then why aren't you? I said, I don't know. She goes, what are you running from? And it caught my attention. I said, what do you mean? She goes, what are you running from? There's something going on with you that you're running from and you don't want to deal with. And I didn't know what it was. For a long time, I didn't know what it was. And I already had like 3 years in the program. And I remember when I first came into the program, what my problem was, I had a problem with men. Any women have a problem with men? I'm the only one, huh? I'm the only one. But I had a lot of anger towards men. I remember when I first got into the program in 09, I only had 9 months clean, and I went to this Halloween dance. And it was Halloween, mind you, so I wore this real small, tiny little skirt, and I don't dress like that. I wore these 3-inch heels with these fishnet stockings, I think that's what they're called, and a real tiny, skimpy shirt that said, Next America's Top Model. And then I put / hooker. So I went to this dance, and I even had the fishnet gloves that came up to my elbow, and nobody asked me to dance. Not one person. I felt like crap. I was pissed. I was angry with all you men. You know, they would walk by and smile, but they wouldn't come up and ask me to dance. They wouldn't approach me. And then one day I mentioned that in a meeting, and of course I wasn't very nice about it. I thought, you mother effers, and you know, I was going off and telling them all this stuff. Not one of you guys asked me to dance and this and that. And a friend of mine came up to me. Matter of fact, it's Bernard's sponsee. Tony C came up to me and he goes, you know, Mary, I can tell you one thing, and I know I can tell you like this because I know I'm your friend. I've been your mom's friend for many years. You know, if I saw you walking down the street, I wouldn't approach you either. And I was like, but why? He said, because when you talk, you could hear the anger that you have towards men. You could hear the issues you have. And I was like, wow, is it that bad? You know, I didn't know. Of course, we can't see ourselves. So he pointed it out to me, and I think that's what I was running from, because I didn't want to have to deal with men. I was single for a long time, and the people that I did date, not in the program, they were always outside the program because I didn't want you people to know what I was doing. So I would date these people, and I would only give them like 3-4 months, and then once they start telling me, oh, I love you, and we should get married, nope, it's time for you to go. It's time for you to burn rubber and get out of, you know, get out. So they would. I would cut that relationship loose and, you know, stay single for another year or so, and then I'd jump in another one, and same thing. Nope, it's time for you to go. 3 or 4 months, it's time for you to go. One of them, I had moved in. This was before I came back to the program. You know, I thought, well, instead of drinking and driving, why not start dating the guy next door? I could just walk home if I have to. If I'm too drunk, I could just crawl home, right? It's just right next door. So then, I moved him into the house, and, you know, of course my kids were upset and pissed off, and cause he was the next bulldog, and it was all bad. But anyways, he was the first one that had to go, because he kept talking about, yeah, I can pay half the rent, and we could get married, and, you know, we could have a baby boy, and, oh, hell no, it's time for you to go. Because I wasn't even divorced yet, you know. And that was my excuse, and that's why I didn't get divorced for a long time, because I kept saying, I can't, I'm married, how can I marry you, you know. So for a long time I didn't get divorced, and you know, I kept dating like that, and they only lasted for a little while, and then I told my sponsor, I said, you know what, I've never given myself a chance. For you single women that are here, give yourself a chance. Give yourself that year that your sponsor says, you know, to give yourself a year, take care of you, learn all about yourself, take care of your issues and your baggage. You know, and when God's ready, he'll bless you with somebody. You know, right before my year was up, God sent me Daniel. You know, I prayed for a man like Daniel. I prayed for a man that would be in the same boat as I am. You know, we're both clean and sober. We're both working the program. We both do speaking engagement. And we both run meetings. You know, we have so much in common. It's shocking. It was amazing to me when I first started noticing all the stuff we have in common. But, you know, that saying that says, you know, watch what you pray for, because, you know, God's going to end up blessing you with it. Well, I prayed and prayed and prayed for a man like Daniel, and I finally got him. And the way my life is today, I wouldn't trade it for nothing in the world. You know, I've waited so long to have a man like him. And for me to lose him now, it would be devastating. You know, because he knows everything about my past, and I know everything about his. We can talk about everything under the sun. We sit there and communicate, and that's something I never had. I was always walking on eggshells with my ex. I couldn't talk to him, or, you know, when he came home, I never knew what kind of attitude he was going to be in. I always had to make sure the boys were in bed, because if he came home, you know, yelling and screaming, I didn't want the boys to hear it. Or I didn't want the boys to end up getting him upset because he was tired and hungry and all this other crap. I always made sure his dinner was on the table when he got home. So I started reading all these self-help books to try to make this relationship work, and it just didn't. When it's not blessed, it's not going to work. When it's blessed by God, it's going to work out. So for the long time, I always prayed for a man like him, and when he got to meet my mom before she passed away last year, I believe my mom gave me her blessing. She told me, you know, she sat there and she just met this man, and she talked to him for maybe not even a half hour. She turned around, looked at me, she goes, "Mary, this man's a keeper. You better keep him." And I looked at him, I said, "Yes, Mom, I will." That's why I'm still with him. We were already hitting our year mark, but we've been together for 3 years now, not 3 months. We're planning on getting married in May, so I'm excited about that. You know, he proposed to me. I've never been proposed to before, and I've never been engaged to anyone. My first marriage was like, "Hey, let's do this." "Okay, let's go." And we did it. So it was, you know, like, it wasn't nothing special. For you ladies that are here, give yourself a chance. You know, pray and tell God what kind of man you want in your life, and he will bless you with that kind of a man. I truly believe that. But for the newcomers that are here, give yourself a chance, and hopefully you'll stick around and learn how to live on a whole different level. You know, take advantage of the program, because everything here is free. You know, they tell me that when we go to meetings, it's like a group therapy. You know, you don't have to pay for it here, but if you go to a therapist on a one-on-one basis, you got to pay $100 and something. You know, so take advantage of the program. I wish I would have when I was young. You know, when I speak, when I share in different meetings where I come from, there's a lot of youngsters. I mean, they're early 19s, 18s, you know, they're early 20s. You know, I always tell people, you know, I'm too old to be chasing the bag. I just look young. You know, I tell people, I'm too old to be chasing the bag, chasing the bottle, chasing him, chasing her, chasing it, whatever. You know, leave it for the youngsters. But if you stop and take a look around, the youngsters are among us today. You know, this disease does not play. This disease is out to kill us all. You know, young or old, it doesn't matter. But my mom was 72 when she passed away. She would have had 28 years clean and sober when she passed. A lot of her little cliches that we use today, I'm still learning how to, dissect them, I guess. You know, she told me about the committee in the head. I used to think she was losing her mind. I'm like, "What a fucking committee? What the hell's that?" You know, I'm like, "A committee in the head? What the hell's that?" And then I just went through it not so long ago. I went in through a deep depression. And the only thing my little head was telling me, that I was tired of being a mom. I was tired of running my kids here and there. You know, I was tired of paying the bills. I was tired of being a single mom. You know, I was tired of being alone. I was tired of being lonely. And I was just tired of being tired. At the time, I didn't know it, though. I wouldn't answer my phone. Thank God nobody comes to my house. Today, all kinds of grandkids come to my house. And, you know, his kids, which is awesome. I don't have no family in Fresno. The only ones I had was my mom and my aunt, and they both passed away already. I have a sister that's there now, but she's on a dry drunk. So I really don't have no one but Daniel and his family, and he has a big family, and it's an awesome thing. But when she would tell me all these little cliches, I never really understood them until today. Today I'm still learning, and, you know, one thing, I know I'm not going to stop learning in this program. Every day I learn something new, every day I hear something new. And when I read the book, I read something different. You know, I think it's because when you read the book the first time, sometimes you're not ready to get the message. And when you read it the second time, you're like, "Hey, I read this book before, and I've never seen this passage or never heard of it or whatever." And that's why it's good to read a book more than once, more than twice. You know, I think. But when I first read the book, I never found my story until I came back to this program. You know, it talks about the blackout drinkers. That's me, because I don't drink every weekend or every day or, you know, all the time. But when I did drink, I always went into blackouts. Never remembered what happened or where I went, who I was with or what. But now today I can honestly say that I am a full-blown alcoholic. And with that, the newcomers that are here, give yourself a chance, man. You guys deserve it. And with that, I'll keep coming back. Thank you.